Questions 14 to 16 are based on the opening speech of the chairman of the final session in an international conference and a statement made by Dr. Martin. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 14 to 16.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we all know, there are great problems inherent in specialist conferences' concentration on specific areas of scientific research. This was the chief reason for us to plan a truly interdisciplinary conference on the complex subject of decision sciences. Equally, however, there are dangers in bringing together so many experts from so many different disciplines. It takes a genuine effort for a person in one discipline to listen to something else which may be totally unfamiliar to him. Not only to listen, but to absorb. The benefits from it are, however, substantial. The work of others may help us define our own work more clearly and may give us ideas for future work, which we would not otherwise be able to obtain. Well, now in the final session, we are going to consider societal decision-making. And this theme will be introduced by our first speaker, Dr. Martin from Cambridge University. Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At first, I would like to make a statement on behalf of the committee of this conference. In attempting to prepare our summaries of the group's discussions, my fellow committee members and I have found the task to be considerably more difficult than we had envisaged. We would like to be able to present in brief and rather simple language the main themes of your discussions and the questions remaining in particular areas. We have discovered that the different vocabularies used by the different groups of experts have caused considerable confusion among many of the conference participants. For this reason, we would like to ask the main speakers from the different sections to meet in the lobby immediately after this session. Thank you. Now, my subject today is... You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 14 to 16. Questions 17 to 20 are based on the following conversation between Professor Lambert and Dale Kohler. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 17 to 20. These are lovely buildings. I've never been to this part of the university before.
It's a bit out of the way. Where do you normally hang out?
Computer labs, sir. I'm a research assistant for a special project on a combined government and private sector grant.
We haven't introduced ourselves. I, of course, am Roger Lambert.
Dale Kohler, sir. I really appreciate your seeing me.
Let's sit down. You said you know my sister's daughter, Verna. I'm very curious to know how she's doing. Very.
Now, it's not very so good, sir. Her little girl is about 1.5, and I guess that's a demanding age. At least Verna says the kid is driving her crazy, babbling and getting to things all the time. The project she's living in is not a good place. She has no real friends.
Is there anything you think I could do for Verna?
Do what I do, sir. Remember her in your prayers.
That is certainly the least I can do. Do give her my love when you see her next time.
Also, if I may say, you could visit her yourself.
She has not once sought to reach me. Now, was there anything you wanted to talk to me about?
Yes, I was wondering, sir, about a grant. Whether the university would like me to pursue what I've been doing. Are you giving me the green light on my project?
Not at all. It's not for me to give you a light of any color. If you want to apply for a special research grant from the university, they have all the appropriate forms in the front offices downstairs. The head of the grants committee is a very nice man, I can tell you, called Jesse Closen. Good luck.
We'll be in touch.
You now have 40 seconds to check your answers to questions 17 to 20. That is the end of Part B. Part C. You will hear part of a speech given by a university president on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of Peking University. As you listen, you must answer questions 21 to 30 by writing not more than 3 words in the space provided on the right. You will hear the speech twice. You now have 60 seconds to read questions 21 to 30. The 100th anniversary of China's 1898 reforms and of Peking University is a special occasion. It merits the gathering of university presidents from around the world. The establishment of this university signaled China's commitment to create a university that would serve the nation and the world and that would meet international standards of scholarly excellence. The many accomplishments of Beida in the intervening years, as well as its moments of despair, are known throughout the world. At the dawn of a new century, the original vision enunciated by its early leaders is at least within grasp. Of this I am confident. All will benefit as Beda draws upon the remarkable talents of this nation to become a leading center of creativity and innovation in the 21st century. But, like my university, and like universities around the world, Beda faces a major question. What qualities are necessary to serve society through excellence? This is the topic of my address. I am often asked to explain the secret ingredients of Stanford's relations with the Silicon Valley. The Silicon Valley had become a metaphor the world over for a productive relationship between a university and the surrounding region. And many visitors to Stanford seek to know the reasons for its success. The answer is to be found not in some secret that Stanford had discovered, but rather in its rigorous adherence to several fundamental but universal purposes and characteristics of a research-intensive university. In using the term research-intensive university, I mean something very specific. Systems of higher education have become highly diversified and meet a variety of needs, especially societal needs for a skilled workforce. The institutions that have emerged to face these challenges are frequently labeled universities. There is nothing wrong with this other than definitional confusion. What I have in mind, however, is an institution that meets three criteria. It selects its students. It is primarily dedicated to the search for knowledge. And it is marked by a spirit of critical inquiry. For simplicity's sake, I shall call this the research-intensive university. I do not use the common American designation research university because, as will become apparent, I do not think of the university as a research institute, but as an institution where the intensity of research is part and parcel of the traditional university functions of teaching and learning. What research-intensive universities need to do now, as the 21st century approaches, is to think much harder about what distinguishes them as institutions from other societal institutions engaged in teaching. In order to bring into sharper focus for themselves and for society, what is their unique and lasting task? And while some of that thinking bears on the non-secret I shall discuss today, its more crucial purpose is to clarify for the next century a role that was delineated most clearly nearly 200 years ago. To begin, I should like to go back to the last decade of the 19th century, the year in which both Peking University and Stanford were founded. In the United States alone, three major universities were formed at about the same time: Johns Hopkins, Stanford, and the University of Chicago. As we know, Peking University resulted from the 100-day reform of 1898 and was made the pinnacle of a multi-layered educational system that was meant to modernize the education and training of officials. The first element of the non-secret regarding Stanford's productive relationship with Silicon Valley is the university's fundamental commitment to the building of scholarly steeples of excellence in research, learning, and teaching, not to the training as such of engineers and business managers. With universities seemingly hopelessly confused about their mission as they enter the 21st century, it is a matter of urgency to reflect on the university's core tasks and not be diverted by those who want the university to be all things to all people. The second element of Stanford's non-secret is that, in spite of innumerable temptations, it has remained an institution that sees the combination of teaching and research as what it is primarily about. Stanford developed an enduring institutional character that at its core does not change. Therein lies the university's advantage. It seems to me that in those universities, overwhelmed by the sheer number of students, or in countries in which research and teaching are fundamentally or even partially separated, much creative force lies nowhere. My point is not that university teaching should be based on university research, but that university research benefits from teaching. Not just from teaching graduate students, but also from teaching first-year students. The third important aspect of Stanford's non-secret must be taken into consideration: the university's freedom to... Now you are going to hear the recording a second time. You now have 100 seconds to check your answers to questions 21 to 30.